ground than we're used to, we're going to take a look at verses 12 through 20. And we're going to see an extremely pivotal point in the life of Judah. We are beginning to see God work providentially to prepare the individual who's going to be next in the lineage of Messiah, who's going to carry God's purpose through to where the seed of the woman is going to crush the serpent's head someday. All right, so we are going to take a look, first of all, at the first seven verses here. Watch out when pagans celebrate. Okay, so that's a good general principle for any age. In the course of time, the wife of Judah, Shua's daughter, died. Poor woman makes her entrance into the narrative, does her part, dies, and we still don't know her name. She's just the daughter of Shua. She's a Canaanite. Judah should have never been married to a Canaanite. When Judah was comforted, he went up to Timnah to his sheep shearers. He and his friend Hira the Adullamite. All right, so this was a very festive time in the whole of Palestine. It's analogous to the Feast of Harvest. And it would be a great rejoicing. Now these sheep have had a whole year to grow their wool, and they're ready to be shorn. And, of course, there'd be a huge influx of income from something like this. It was what the sheep shearers look forward to all year long. They get to do their thing. I don't know if you've ever watched sheep shearing. I never have. But I've seen a special on it in Australia. These sheep shearers, it's big business. And they have to do it fast. It's unbelievable how fast they can shear a sheep. It's like your mouth drops open. Wow. And they go through hundreds and hundreds of these sheep. And they come in all nice and woolly, and they leave all nice and skinny, and no wool left hardly, just a little bit to cover them, just keep them from freezing to death. So it's really quite an impressive event. And as well, the sheep shearing celebration in Palestine among the Canaanites was also a time of wickedness. All right, so along with the rejoicing went wickedness. In other words, imagine religion getting this bad, that they would have what they called sacred prostitutes. In Hebrew, the term is kodeshim. They're literally holy ones. Well, they were wholly set apart. They were for one purpose in the Canaanite temples. They were to service the male worshipers. And in doing this, they were soliciting the favor of whatever false god they were worshiping and joining him to give them agricultural prosperity and the health of their flocks, and most importantly, the reproduction of their flocks. So they thought if they participated in human acts of reproduction, that it would stimulate somehow the god to move and create productivity in the reproduction of their flocks. You say, that doesn't make any sense. That's crazy. That's just an excuse for men to give rise to their sensual natures. And that's a good example of the complete and absolute debauchery of pagan culture. say, things could never get that bad in the U.S. Why, we wouldn't put up with it. Oh, really? You haven't seen anything yet. As paganism becomes more the culture of our day, there's no telling how bad religion could get in the United States. So this is a time of the year when sensuality was the tour de force for this time period. It was a time that I would imagine the men looked forward to all year long. They were all geared up for this. And this is the culture that Judah was a part of now. I want you to see that marrying the daughter of Shua, a Canaanite, was not some neutral thing that Judah did. He willingly placed himself within this kind of pagan, debauched culture. Wow. Can anybody think of something that you could do, that a believer could do today, that would be anywhere near equivalent to this? Now, granted, it's worse, ostensibly, than anything we can think of today, but there are other things. For instance, let me give you an example. I'll prime the pump. All right, now, when I took my first job as a process engineer, years and years ago now, I was invited to a Christmas party. A party. Oh, doesn't that sound terrific? Sure, I'll go to the party. Bad mistake. All right? Because the game at the party was, let's see who can identify the most different kinds of beer. All right? So, somebody's got to set the game up because he had numbered cups and it was secret what kind of beer you poured into which numbered cups. And somebody had to keep track of how many people guessed right and how many were wrong. And the only person who can do that is somebody who's not going to participate in the game. Oh, let's get Yegley. He doesn't drink. They knew that about me already. They knew I didn't do what they did. And I should have never been there at their little party, participating in their debauched celebration of Christmas. This is what Christmas was to them. What, not a time to worship the coming king? Worship the immense, infinite mystery of God taking on human flesh to live a sinless life for us and die a vicarious death in our place. No, Christmas time was a time of drinking and other stuff. All right. Won't tell you about the other stuff. Too embarrassing. All right. So here I am. I'm caught. Yes, I should have never come here. Here I am. Now I'm in charge of the drinking game. So I dutifully numbered all the cups. I distributed the right, the beer in particular numbered cups. And I kept track of who guessed right and who guessed wrong. And then, at the end of the game, I declared the winner. One of the guys that didn't win, who was amply soused by that time, he probably had the equivalent of, I don't know, half a gallon of beer. I'm not sure how much they drank. They were just little teeny cups, but you drink enough of those things, they must have had 20 or 30 different kinds of beer. He looks at me in his drunken state and says, well, some kind of Christian you are, giving us beer to drink. Oh, that hurt. Man, that hurt. I shouldn't have been there in the first place. I was so naive, I had no idea what went on at Christmas parties for a bunch of unsaved people. Well, I found out. And I said to this fellow, I doubt he ever remembered what I said, because he's so drunk. I said, "You're right. This is something I shouldn't have done. Lord willing, I'm going to make this mistake again." And I didn't. Never went back to another one. But there's the kind of thing in a pagan culture, even what started as sincere religious worship times ends up being simply debauchery. And that's what Judah got into. So Tamar, being the lady she was, reasons that this would be the optimal time to spring a trap. You know, there's this heightened sense of sensuality. Everybody expects men to be consorting with prostitutes. So this is why she picks this time to spring a trap that she had been devising for quite some time. All right? I mean, here she'd been living in her father's house, doing just what Judah had told her to do, waiting for Shelah to get big enough so he could marry her. Well, he's old enough now, but Judah's not making any attempt to get them married. Does anybody remember why? Why wasn't Judah interested in marrying his final son to Tamar? The other two are dead. The Lord had killed them. And so they were wicked. And, basically, one dies, maybe just a coincidence. Two die, and all of a sudden it's not a coincidence anymore, it's a precedent. And so Judah's thinking, "Nah, I know I told her that I would do this," but Judah had no intention at all. Notice, when Tamar was told, "Your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep," she took off her widow's garments and covered herself with a veil, wrapping herself up, and sat at the entrance to Anayim, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah was grown up, and she had not been given to him in marriage. Now, she wants to raise up offspring in memory of her, one dead husband and one brother-in-law who's not really ever married her. He's just pleasuring himself with her. And she's got to do something, she says to herself. Otherwise, I'll never produce offspring to perpetuate the memory of my one dead husband, my one dead brother-in-law. And so she's got to take matters into her own hands, she thinks. All right, so after she had veiled herself, put on the appropriate attire, Tamar positioned herself as provocatively as possible, no doubt, where she had learned that Judah would be traveling. Now, did a little research on harlot attire. And it's kind of a mixed bag in the ancient world here. Sometimes harlots would indeed veil themselves, but that was by no means a universal practice. We assume that, of course, Tamar did this, so there was no way that Judah would recognize her. And it defeated the purpose, sort of, to be veiled, because harlots in the ancient world would paint their faces in a rather excessive and sort of bizarre manner. You know, it's kind of like, you know, you go to a restaurant and your waitress shows up and she's got piercings everywhere she can have them, and she's wearing a short sleeve blouse. Her entire arm is colored tattoos, and she's got bizarre makeup on. And you're saying to yourself, great, heavenly days. Look at this. Does this woman have no shame? She's presenting herself in such a bizarre manner. I'm not even sure I'm going to get my food. And then as you give your order and find out, well, she's a pretty capable waitress. It's just that's getting to be more the way things go these days. Women are taking more extreme measures. Look at me. Wow. I'm not ordinary. Yeah, that's for sure. You're not ordinary. But all these center on the external. So this is exactly what a typical harlot would do. But Tamar can't do that because she wants to make sure that that Judah doesn't recognize her. Otherwise, the whole ruse is over with. So sure enough, Judah thought she was a harlot, made provisions to have sex with her. So when Judah saw her, verse 15 says, he thought she was a prostitute, for she had covered her face. Now, that little word "for" could be a causal idea. So in other words, Judah thought she was a prostitute because she had veiled herself. Or it could be a concessive idea. Judah saw that she had veiled herself, that she was a prostitute even though she had veiled herself, which would have been unusual for a prostitute. Take your pick. The commentators argue all over the place as to whether this is a causal key or a concessive key. And I don't know that we'll ever solve this. I prefer the translation Judah saw her and he thought she was a prostitute even though she had covered her face. Concessive idea. He turned to her at the roadside and said, come, let me come into you. Well, no chit-chat here. No beating around the bush, so to speak. It's right to the point. Apparently, Judah is really focused on this. Of course, his wife has died. So he's at a point of higher sensitivity to solicitation for sensuality. It's a time of the year when everybody's thinking about this if you're a guy. And so this is basically Tamar is springing the perfect trap here. For he did not know, last part of verse 16 says, that she was his daughter-in-law. Why, if he'd known that, he wouldn't have gone anywhere near her. Because in the ancient world, it was typically considered to be incest for a man to have sex with his daughter-in-law. Unless all of his sons were dead or he was out of sons, no more sons left to do the levirate marriage, in which case, according to most Canaanite law that we have any record of, it was the father-in-law's responsibility to do the levirate function. But this is not anywhere near in force here because Judah already has a living son left. He's just not giving her to Tamar. So there's none of that involved. It would be just plain, in-your-face, egregious incest if Judah had relations with his daughter-in-law and he knew it. And of course, later on, in Mosaic law, it's built in right into the Mosaic law. What was to happen if a father-in-law were to do something like that? Have sexual relations with his daughter-in-law. That's sick. What was the penalty for something like that? Both people were to be stoned to death. Boy, I don't know about you, but I think getting stoned would be a pretty horrific way to go. Now, they wouldn't take just small little pebble-sized rocks. They'd get somebody down in a pit, which would ultimately be their grave, and they would take as big a stone as they could pick up, walk over to the edge of the pit, and with all their might throw that thing down on top of the person who was getting stoned, and it would break bones, break skulls. It was a pretty horrific way to go. So he would have never gone anywhere near Tamar if he'd known that she was... If he'd known she was his daughter-in-law. So he generously agrees to pay her with a kid from his flock of goats. That was a fairly high price to pay for the services of a prostitute in this day and age. We have record of payment as small as a loaf of bread. Well, what's a loaf of bread compared with an animal, a live, viable animal who can give you goat's milk and goat cheese and all the other things that goats can be beneficial for, worth way more than probably most. I don't know whether he was trying to impress his friend Hira, or who was with him, or what his idea here was, but of course he didn't have an animal like that with him, and so he offered to give a pledge, because Tamar says, "What will you give me that you may come into me?" He said, "I'll send you a young goat from the flock." And she said, "Well, if you give me a pledge until you send it..." And he said, before she even got a chance to finish her sentence, he's in so much of a hurry, apparently, to engage her services, "What pledge shall I give you?" All right, now, wow. Look at the pledge she wants. Oh, she's been thinking about this. She needs something, so to speak, as a get-out-of-jail card, a get-out-of-jail-free card, like in Monopoly. Yeah, you got one of those, oh, man, you're really in good shape. Because if you land in jail, you can get out immediately. And she wants some way to be able to identify with absolutely no doubt that Judah is the one who engaged her services. Why would there be no doubt? Well, the cord most likely was a cord that somebody wore around their neck, and at the end of the cord was a signet seal. These came in various types. If you were very wealthy, you could afford a metal worker to fashion this in gold or silver. Or maybe if you were a cheapskate, bronze. And it was a unique pattern that only you had. It might as well have been like wearing his fingerprints around his neck or his DNA analysis. There's nobody else that would have had that signet. They were very expensive to have done up, and only the best artisans in town did these kinds of things. And then he had as well, oh, by the way, sometimes they were made out of stone, too. Whatever the case, nobody else would have had one of these except Judah. And then he had his staff, and people in these days made staffs that were like that as well. They were highly personalized. Maybe it had the picture of the seal on the staff. And so it would likewise identify a person immediately as the one and only person who could have possibly owned this. So now she's got two irrefutable proofs that Judah is the one that has had relations with her. And so he gave them to her. And he had sex with her. And notice the statement that is made by the Lord as he informs Moses as to what the outcome of this was. Basically, and she conceived by him. And it didn't take much time. It's like the Lord himself directed that conception and ensured that even after only one instance of relation that she would conceive. That she wouldn't just conceive one child, that she would conceive two. Twins were conceived that day. And so, as the reader, we're informed immediately about what Judah didn't have a clue about. And what an incredibly stupid thing to deposit with Tamar as a pledge. Hey, wasn't he thinking? Well, sinners don't really think about stuff like this. I mean, all he's concerned about is his own pleasure, and he doesn't want anything to get in the way of that, and he's just not even thinking about it. Unbelievable. But that's what he did. So there's the trap setting up, and here now, the trap is going to be sprung. He's walking right into this well-crafted thing that Tamar has devised. When Judah sent the young goat by his friend Hira the Adullamite to take back the pledge from the woman's hand, he did not find her. Oh, surprise, surprise. She's absconded with a pledge. She didn't want the little goat in the first place. She wanted irrefutable proof of who has impregnated her. And he asked the men of the place, where is the cult prostitute? Now that's the Hebrew word, not just for your common prostitute, who was called a zonah, but this is the Kodesh prostitute. This is the temple prostitute. I suppose that Hira didn't want to insult the men of the city by saying, well, where's the zonah? Because that would have been indicative of a society that was even looser than the typical Canaanite society. They wouldn't have allowed just plain old garden variety street prostitutes to be plying their business in town. It would be insulting to suggest that. And so he gives her the benefit of the doubt here and says, how about that cult prostitute? That would have been perfectly acceptable with the men of the town. So he uses that term. And they said, no cult prostitute has been here. So now what's Hira going to do? Judah replied, let her keep the things as her own, or we shall be laughed at. So you can imagine, he's made his inquiry. The men tell him, nope, sorry, we've never seen one of these just out by the street side. And now if he starts to look any further, people are going to say, look at that idiot. Look what he's going around trying to find, you know, this girl who has something he really wants, and he's not going to find her. Let's just watch and see what happens. We need a good laugh today. And he and Judah are going to be laughing stocks. And so Judah says, "Oh, give it up. We'll never find her. I can have another signet made. I'll get another staff. So don't worry about it. You see, I sent this young goat, and you did not find her." In Judah's mind, he has essentially met his requirement. He tried to give the girl payment, but apparently she didn't care enough to hang around, and she can't be found. So he really has no other recourse. If he's worried that a harlot has his signet, the thought of becoming an object of personal ridicule outweighs any zeal he might have in getting his signet back. He can't imagine it will ever affect anything anyway. Probably this woman would not even try to steal his identity because she's a female, and typically males are the ones who would wear these things around their necks like that. So just give it up. So now he's in the trap. And now the trap is about to be sprung. Here we go. Verse 24. "About 3 months later, Judah was told, 'Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has been immoral. Moreover, she is pregnant by immorality.'" So, about 3 months go by. Tamar can't conceal her pregnancy any longer. And when Judah finds out about it, look what his reaction is. Number one, why was Judah pronouncing the sentence of death on this daughter-in-law of his? Was that his prerogative to do that? I mean, he's not the judge and jury and executioner. This was not his right to do this. But somehow he thinks it is. And so what does he say? "Bring her out and let her be burned." Well, there was no penalty for burning somebody who had been adulterous. Now, the person with whom she had been adulterous with, and she could be stoned, but apparently Judah has lived so long in Canaanite culture where it could be the penalty assessed for immorality like this, for adultery. And in fact, that was what she was guilty of. And so apparently it could have happened. Now Tamar is in mortal danger. Probably the men of the city would have gone along with this, and they would have in fact burned her. As she was being brought out, in other words, she's being led to the stake. "Okay, guys, let's get some wood together. Let's burn this woman. We're going to do exactly what Judah says here." It could be that Judah had risen to some level of prominence in that area. After all, he had the signet. That was indicative of an upper-class type of individual, very successful. And so, here she is. She's being let out. What does she say? Well, she's got her get-out-of-jail-free card, as I mentioned. She's pregnant then, she says, by the man who owns the signet, the cord, and the staff. Please identify whose these are, the signet and the cord and the staff. Now, Judah does not try to deny that they're his. Why do you suppose that is? Why wouldn't Judah say, "Oh, never seen those before. I have no idea whose those are." No, why did he not try that, do you suppose?
Did he say they were very personal?
Very personal. No doubt Judah had used those things to seal documents, to seal business transactions, and everybody in town probably knew that they were his. No sense denying it. It's just as airtight a case as anybody can imagine that, in fact, those are his. So now he's caught. Now here is a statement that I want you to take note of and see if you can come up with why you think this is true. Judah identifies them, he takes ownership, and then he says, "She is more righteous than I," and then he gives the reason why she is, "because I did not give her my son Shelah." What does that have to do with being more righteous? I mean, here Tamar is guilty of adultery. She's guilty of deception. Oh, here we come across the theme of deception once again. That's a theme that runs all the way through the patriarchal narratives, but comes out most strongly, of course, in the narrative of Jacob. Now, deception again, of a high and aggravated nature. And yet, Judah, the person who just simply naively walks into this trap, says by implication, "I'm less righteous." All right, now the key is found right there in the verse. Who sees it? What's the explanation for how Tamar could be considered more righteous? It all boils down to the definition of righteous. All right, here's a term that is widely used throughout the Scripture, and yet, especially in the Old Testament, if you were to ask 99 out of 100 people in churches like ours, what's the definition of righteous? People might look at you and say, well, upstanding in moral behavior. Yeah, you're going in the right direction. But there's more to it than that. Righteousness is meeting an expected standard of conduct that matches the standard to which people are judged. So in the Old Testament, what's the standard of righteousness for all people who say they know God? His word, His character. He alone is righteous. He's the one to whom, who is the model, the standard to which all other righteousness is judged. And so when Paul says in the New Testament, there's no one who is righteous, no, not one. What's he in effect saying? Compared with God, there's no way you could possibly match His standard of moral perfection. He is the standard. No one even registers on the scale of righteous comparison with Him. Everybody except our Savior is unrighteous compared with Him. See, man's problem is we have the wrong standard of comparison. Have you ever noticed that? Yes. Question. Yes. She is realizing that she's never going to be married. She'll never have a husband to love and watch out for her and prepare and give her a child that can be an heir to her law or to her dead husband. And so that's what she's centering in on. She is centering in on what the righteous standard would be for her in this cultural context. And in that sense, she is indeed more righteous than Judah, who has absolutely zero intention of letting her marry his final son. So in fact, Judah is less righteous. She is more righteous. Although, from an absolute standpoint, compared with the righteousness of God, she's no more righteous or unrighteous than Judah or anybody else would have been. So, I see it all the time. Anyone who's a teacher no doubt sees this too. Students take a test. I grade the test. I pass the test back. What's the first thing some students in class will do? Look over at the person who's sitting next to them and see what that person got. And then they congratulate themselves because they did better than the person sitting next to them. One time, I saw it happen, and the guy who was sitting next to this inquirer as to what score he got a D. He got a C minus. Oh, congratulations to me. I beat this guy sitting next to me. Crazy. I used to have a guy, when we were seated alphabetically in grad school, this guy, I won't tell you his whole name, I don't want to embarrass him, but he was close to my spelling. So we always sat next to each other when the teacher seated us alphabetically. And he was always insatiably curious as to what I got on a test. And he was also invariably disappointed when he looked at my test score. And the next test would come up, he'd say, I'm going to beat you today. His whole reason for studying, apparently, was to be able to look at my test and say, ha, I beat you. Never happened. Very, very disappointed young man. And so finally one day I said to him, look, I'm not the standard of comparison. The test grade master is. And you're judged according to that, not according to my paper. Don't look at me. Just assess how you did and determine to do better for the Lord's glory and quit comparing yourself to me. No brag, just fact. It was just never beat me. Too bad. He should have picked somebody else. Oh, absolutely. Oh, hypocrisy to the high heavens. Absolutely. This is a sad thing about sin. Stop to think. How hypocritical is sin? Invariably so. And so Judah is caught dead to rights. Now, when he admits that Tamar has been more righteous than this than he is in effect owning his sin. Look in vain for some kind of excuse making that Judah does. You won't find it. Judah identified these things of his and said, "She is more righteous than I, since I did not give her to my son Shelah." And he never had relations with her again. Now that he knows, you know, what the ruse was. And so what ends up happening? Well, we have no record that he ever gave Shelah to her as wife, as a husband. But it does progress to show the outcome of his incest with her. Yes, Peggy? Oh, yes. I assume so. Because, in fact, those twins were his. So I assume she went along. Now, yes. And so, you know, essentially, we see the grace of God to this woman because she becomes the first non-Israelite member of the lineage of Christ. Can you imagine the grace of God that takes a Canaanite lost person, and because she is so insistent on being a part of this lineage, that she's willing. How would she know what God has in plan for Judah? I don't know the answer to that question. I think there's a backstory that Moses isn't giving us here, but somehow or another, this woman, from her pagan background, does the only thing she knows to do to become a part of a wonderful lineage. God's grace to her, almost unbelievable grace. Yet, wait a minute. What about us? Is there anybody here who could say, by raise of hand, "Oh, I deserve the salvation that God graciously gave me. And since I've been saved, I've never done anything wrong." Wow. That would be the utmost in pride, wouldn't it? Hubris to the high heavens. Of course, God was gracious to Tamar, as He is to us. All right, so the twins are born. Once again, we have the same thing. Perez, the younger, is chosen to continue the messianic line. And Zerah, we don't hear much from again. So God providentially used even deception and sexual sin to produce His desired lineage for the Messiah. Man's sin never thwarts God's providence. So now, very quickly, can you see why chapter 38 is where it is? You know the rest of the story. While this is going on with Judah, he can't seem to pass a prostitute without engaging her services. We're about to see in chapter 39 that Joseph, even under day-by-day provocation by Potiphar's wife, will not sin. He stands firm in his resolve not to do this wickedness before God. What an amazing contrast! And God has a place of safety in Egypt for His chosen people, to preserve them from being absorbed into the culture of the seed of the serpent, where they can develop as a pure people of God. All right. See you next time.